TLI, transluminal rejection. That's the logic behind that. Unmanned flights, it doesn't matter. You know, we sent a flight called New Horizons to you know, that literally is going out of the solar system. It's going to be similar to the Voyages. When that thing was launched from Earth, it was 9 hours. 9 hours. It all took to get. If the moon was in the way, it would have made it to the moon in 9 hours. They launched on a very large rocket, and again, that was no reason to put it into orbit. The same with James Webb Space Telescope. When that $10 billion project launched, there was no reason to put that into orbit. It was unmanned, and most flights are like that. Space station, of course, you want that to be in orbit. And the future SLS flight with a crew of four that will be going up in about a year and a half, that shit's going to go to the moon and then come back. It's not going to land. You'll find that will be put into Earth orbit first. They'll check everything out, and then they'll get the okay for TLI. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. So N2ZC, question answered now?
Oh, yeah, totally. Thank you, Paul. Very, very nice explanation. And, better grasp on it then now. I didn't realize it was sort of just like a rest stop, let's say, on a highway. check the oil and everything. So, okay. Thank you, Roy, and back to the net.
Okay, very good. Jeff, you have something to ask or say or what have you?
KC2PL negative, waiting for space report.
Okay. Well, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Weimar Technical Net. Theoretically, we got about 10 minutes that still is open. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, then great. Hit that push to talk. Otherwise, I guess we'll just kind of speed up the process and move to SpaceNet report. But it's up to you guys. If you got a question or a comment, please feel free to hit that push to talk button.
I think I try next week.
Okay, hopefully this is a kind of aberrant behavior. You know, the poor guy probably just got a ticket to go home for the holidays, and maybe he'll be back in the insane asylum next week. We will see what we will see, but I appreciate your efforts, Wesley. And I'm sorry that we weren't able to accomplish what we had planned.
Thank you very much.
Okay, once again, I'm out here. We got a few more minutes. We could use them. We can throw them away. Whatever you want to do with them. If you have any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk. Yeah, Jeff.
Roy, do you just want to take just a couple minutes to walk people through how to put Echolink on their phones and their computers? Because it seems like the people who could transition easily were able to pick up the thread, while the people who were stuck with RF in a certain location were wiped out tonight.
Actually, I have a question about that matter. I was trying to log after years in Echolink, and it is asking me for validation again. and I have an email from 2009 that I was validated for according what's going on.
Well, they gave you a password at the time. Did you write down the password?
I can check. It should be there. Okay, I'm going to check it out.
Okay, what Jeff just brought up is a very useful thing. Thank you for the suggestion. Echo Link is a relatively easygoing application. You could run it on your Android, you could run it on your iPhone, you could run it on your iPad, you can run it on your PC, and I think there's some way of running it even on a Macintosh. You go to echolink.org and you download the software for the PC, maybe the app, I'm not 100% sure. You do the installation, you put in your call sign, and you try to connect, and it immediately says you're not verified. So then what you have to do is go back to the Echo Link website, and there are a number of different methods to prove that you're a licensed amateur radio, because once they give you access, you can talk on repeaters. So if you weren't licensed, you'd be violating FCC laws, and they would be violating them with you. So the way that I usually did it, the FCC site has two copies of your license. One says it's a copy, which doesn't count, and one says that it's not a copy. That's the one that they want an image of. And there are a couple of other methods if that doesn't work for you. They're very good about responding. Like I said, I sent a question, and about a half hour later I got an answer. So, you know, within a day, unless it's some major holiday, they will give you a password to use with your call sign to get on to your PC's Echo Link. As far as cell phones and such, you go to the Google Store, you go to the Apple Store, and you search for Echo Link, and you download the app, and it's kind of the same thing. You plug in your call sign, and if you already have your password, you use the password. If not, you have to go through the same authentication. You get the password. And then you're set up. And if you want to talk on the LIMARC repeater, you just look for W2VL-R and put it in your favorites node and click it, and hopefully it will connect. As I mentioned earlier, there's one little gotcha. If you already have installed Echo Link on a PC in your house, and it's a different IP address, your router is not going to configure it correctly on a second computer. It will see that the router is already port forwarded, and it won't change the setting, and so it won't work on the other computer. For that, you have to go into the settings where it says proxy and select a third-party proxy that works for you. You click on it, and then it will show you the available nodes. And, again, you do a search for W2VL-R, and you're in like Flint. So hopefully that's a kind of relatively simple explanation of how to utilize Echo Link. I found it an extremely useful tool. It was the first amateur radio tool that I ever had. Once I got my license, I didn't have any radios or anything. I took my cell phone and I installed Echo Link and connected to this repeater and spoke to a gentleman by the name of Alex, who was in Rome. Timed out the system, but I'm back now. Anyway, I hope you have all understood what I was trying to get across. If you have any questions, please feel free. I guess that was our friend saying that he was still there. Anyway, please avail yourself of EchoLink, like I said before. It's very useful, and it was the first tool that I used once I had my license. And, you know, I talked to Romania. Anyway, always a pleasure talking to all you guys. Thank you so much for your continued participation, even amongst this nonsense that goes on in the background. And please, I'll be back a little bit later at the end of the net. But now it's a perfectly great time for Paul WS2N with a SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good. And we have two more topics we can go through here. And, of course, we can always take questions. There's a company called Firefly. They've launched four rockets so far from California. And they're developing not reusable rockets, but now, anyway, they're expendable. And they have medium-lift vehicles that they've been used so far. The government has contracted with them. Not NASA, but, you know, the other forms of government. Space Force and all to put satellites into orbit. But this company is also developing a lunar lander, a series of them, and they have one ready to go, and it looks like it's going to be ready to go in the middle of January, so in a couple of months we'll get to see this thing take off from actually, they're going to use SpaceX rocket to launch it. The Firefly rocket is they call it the Alpha rocket. It's not large enough to launch this lander to the moon. It's a good sized lander. It stands about 7 foot high and maybe about 10 or 12 foot wide. You know. It's got four legs on it, so, you know, from one leg to the other, it's almost 12 feet. It's got solar panels on it. It's got 10 different instruments that's going to test equipment once it lands on the moon. But they do need a larger rocket to get it there. So they contracted with SpaceX. They will launch that mid-January from Florida. And we'll see how that does. Firefly is building a larger rocket, but they won't be ready for their lunar lander. Their lunar lander is called the Blue Ghost. The Blue Ghost mission. First one is called Number One, and they have more ready to go as the year. Next couple of years go by, so we'll see if they successfully land not on the South Pole where NASA really wants to land a lot of vehicles. This one is planned to go to Mare Crisium, which is north. Well, if you look at the moon, it's the northeast quadrant of the moon. So about 300-mile wide area that they could land in. So I'm looking forward to seeing this thing go up. I think this one's going to make it. They had a lot of problems. They did have success with one last year by Intuitive Machines, and they have one planned to go next year as well. But this one will be the first one by Firefly. Let me just stop, see if anybody has any comments.
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, this is Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie. How you doing? And do you have any questions?
Yes, on Firefly, I'm looking it up now. When are they going to launch into deep space?
Yeah, that'll be mid-January. So we'll look forward to that, you know, say the second week of January. Unless there's delays, you know, but right now that's the plan for Blue Ghost. And there's a bunch of companies that are looking to land vehicles on the moon. And this one, I think, will probably make it. I mean, they put a lot of money into this vehicle, a lot of research. I think they have a good shot at doing it. Back to you, Charlie.
I'm going to be in Florida mid-January. That's why I'm asking.
Okay, great. It's going off on a SpaceX rocket. So they launched from complex 40 or launch complex 39. I don't know if this is going to go off on 39A or 40. Let me see if I have that here. No, I don't. I don't. One of those two. Yeah, my guess it will probably be 39A, which is the launch complex, maybe about 3 miles away from the vehicle assembly building, that gigantic building that you see when you're down there in Florida at the Cape.
Yes, I'll be down there on the 10th of the evening, and I believe there's a flight on the 11th.
That would be a scheduled flight. That's probably SpaceX as well. You know, they're still launching Starlink satellites, one right after the other. But I hope Blue Ghost makes it. Like I said, they have about 10 different pieces of equipment on board, different instruments. They have the lunar instrumentation for subsurface thermal exploration and rapidity. It's called LISTA. So, you know, it's going to check the heat flow in the moon's surface. There's going to be a probe that they're going to try to drill into the surface. And they'll get all this stuff back and get inside the vehicle. They'll study it right there on the moon, and then they'll transmit that information back to Earth. So it's got four big legs on it, so it looks like a wide span, you know, on the legs, which is good. Less of a chance of the thing tipping over when it lands. That's what happened.
Well, this is the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
I'm sure you pick up, or you go online, and when you're down there, and they'll give you exact information, you know, if the flight has been delayed or whatnot. You probably got a couple of flights then. You're going to stay so or more.
Yeah, but when I look at the launch time, will they tell me in advance if it's being canceled?
Well, yeah, if they know in advance, they always let you know when you look up the schedule. And Florida today is they actually have a paper down there you could read, or you go online, and they give you really good information when you're down there, the exact time something's going to go off or not. But you know, of course, if they get down to 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and there's a computer problem, and it shuts the vehicle down, and you know, sometimes there's an hour delay, or then they can't get it running. You know, 2 hour delay, and next thing you know, scrubbed until, you know, next week or something. But, so you have to look for that. But if you're going to be down there for, you know, 5, 6, 7 days, you know, the average is every 3 or 4 days there's another launch from Florida, you know, one right after the other.
I'm hoping to get that one down there, and when I'm down there for the January. I got a question about Flight 6 that took off last week. Did they remove the heat shield? What was the outcome of it?
Yeah, they took some of the heat shield off that they felt they didn't need. So I guess it worked out okay because, you know, it got through the atmosphere, got down to the Indian Ocean, came down vertically, and, you know, if there was a launch pad there or a landing pad, it would have worked out. But it came down vertically. They had a camera out there on a ship, take pictures of the thing. They had another camera on a buoy somewhere. So, you know, it was very successful. And I haven't heard any results on the heating of the vehicle. I don't think they're going to give that information out. That might be proprietary information for SpaceX. We'll see. Anyway, looking at the computer here, I had another topic I just wanted to just quickly go over, and that has to do with the Europa Clipper mission that launched back in October. It's well underway. It's already opened up its massive solar panels. Solar panels are probably as big as a basketball court. It opened up its magnetometer that came out on it looks like a Rhone tower when it opens up. You know, it expands from the body of the vehicle, and that went out around. I think that was a 30-foot, 20. I think it was 28, but roughly 38 feet away from the vehicle. This tower opened up with the magnetometer on it, on the end of it. That worked out okay. And then attached to these massive solar panels, there's a couple of gigantic dipoles that that was telescopically opened up as well. And that worked out great too. They're like 57 feet or 58 feet long. So, you know, the combination of it is like 116 feet. So it's like putting a 116 foot dipole on one, hanging off the end of a solar panel, and then another one as well on a solar panel. It's going to be capable of operating in different frequencies. You're going to use its transmitters and receivers at the same time to transmit down. To penetrate the ice on Europa when it gets there in 2030. The reason I bring it up, it's for two reasons. You know, successfully has had all their equipment opened up. It looks like there are no problems with the deployment of it. And at the same time, it will be passing Mars very shortly. And when it goes past Mars, they're going to test a bunch of things on it. They have cameras. They want to transmit, you know, using the dipoles, you know, see if they get signals reflected off the Mars surface. You know, make sure everything's working, and you know, kind of make sure it's calibrated for, you know, for when they do reach Europa. Europa, of course, is the moon going out around Jupiter. So after Mars, you know, it continues around orbit around the Sun, it will eventually come back to Earth next year. and not, you know, you, they use Earth as a gravity assist as well, and that will give them the extra push that they need to continue all the way to Jupiter. You know, it's such a massive vehicle. It weighs, I think it's 10 or 11,000 pounds, that, you know, you just can't launch it directly from Earth and head all the way to Jupiter. They have to put it into orbit around the sun, and, you know, as time goes by, another year goes by, it'll be catching back up to Earth, you know, coming up behind Earth. It'll pick up speed from the
Paul, will Europa land on Jupiter?
Okay, it looks like I timed that out. Oh well. Unless somebody has a question about it, let me know. I don't even know where I timed out.
You were talking about Europa going to Jupiter. Will it land or just circulate, take data, and return?
Yeah, it'll just go to orbit around Jupiter. It's actually not going to orbit the moon Europa. It's going to orbit Jupiter. And as it comes around, it'll get close to the moon, close to the moon of Europa. It'll be able to do all its science work, pick up all the information, and then it comes back out of, you know, highly elliptical orbit, again, still around Jupiter, and as it gets further away, it'll get further away from the high-intensity radiation area that surrounds Jupiter, so that's why they need a high elliptical orbit. As it gets further away, it'll transmit all the data back to Earth on X-band, and then it'll go back in again, go close to Europa, and this is going to go on for a couple of years. I plan on doing this 49 different times. And at the end of the mission, they'll probably look for an extended mission, try to do something else. But, yeah, and it will never come back to Earth. It'll stay in the Jupiter system, like, forever. Back to you, Charlie. Yeah, and that rocket, by the way, that's got to be used for, that was used for them, was also a Falcon Heavy vehicle. None of those boosters were recovered. They needed to. They needed all the thrust that they could to launch that thing. So even Falcon Heavy wasn't big enough. Anyway, let's see. Rocket Lab launched a pair of Electron rockets within 24 hours of each other. So it's not only SpaceX that has that capability anymore. In fact, Electron kind of like beat that number. They launched one from New Zealand, from the North Island of New Zealand, and then soon after that, they launched another one from Wallops Island, Virginia. One from New Zealand went into orbit, and they had a couple of satellites on board, and the one from Virginia was not planned on going into orbit. That was actually a suborbital flight. Very high, 1,000 miles high, and then came back down again. They were different science missions for the government, and that did not require that particular electron to go into Earth orbit. But electrons doing Rocket Lab company, Launching Electron, is doing very good. They have another rocket called the Neutron rocket under development. They should launch that one first time next year, and that will also be reusable. Electron rocket is reusable. It comes back on a parachute, lands in the water. They pick it up, but they just haven't reused the boosters yet, although they did take one engine out one time just to see how it would work. And they did reuse one engine. It worked fine. And the new Neutron rocket, which is kind of like a heavy lift vehicle, someday we'll eventually be able to launch people into space. That one is under development, and they have a launch pad already built, again, in Wallops Island, Virginia. So looking forward to that. That would be next year as well, for the first launch. My guess is probably toward the end of the year. Another flight that's planned is called the Dragonfly. Dragonfly will be a JPL NASA flight. And that now just got a contract with SpaceX, and that'll launch on a Falcon Heavy as well. So we'll see how that does a couple of years from now. That one's not going to go to Jupiter. That one's going to go to Saturn and eventually go through the atmosphere of Titan, the biggest moon that goes around Saturn. And it's got 8 blades on it, 8 propeller blades. What it's going to do is it's going to come through the atmosphere. It'll separate from the cruise stage. And when it does that, it'll be like flying through the air. And the propellers will spin up. And at that point, it'll be able to fly into different locations around the moon of Titan. And then eventually land, pick up all the science that it needs, and transmit that back to Earth. And when it's done with that little area, wherever it landed, it will take off again with the 8 propellers, fly to a different location. And they'll keep doing that until they can't do it anymore. Who knows how many flights are going to get out of Dragonfly. And the reason they can do that, it's not solar powered, of course, it's too far away from the sun. So it does have EG on board, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, powered by uranium-238. So, that heats up these graphite blankets. Graphite blankets have thermocouples, hundreds and hundreds of them, and weaved into the blanket. They were parallel or series, whatever it is, and then they put out 109 watts. And I think they're just going to have one on board, maybe two. If they have two, then they'll have over 200 watts. And that will recharge the lithium-ion batteries. When the batteries are completely charged, they'll be able to fly to a different location. So they don't need the sun. And we'll see. I mean, it's been very successful for the two big rovers on Mars right now, Curiosity and Perseverance. They're running on, each one has one RTG, radioisotope thermal electric generator to power those vehicles. Curiosity, what this is, what, 2012? The other one, Perseverance, that landed in 2020, February. Already I got three or more years out of that thing. And that's pretty much it. Any comments? WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, we're going deeper and deeper into space. I know this sounds a little funny, but don't you think they should put a gas station up there?
Yeah. Well, I guess in the future someday you'll have that capability, you know? Have a service station on Mars. Or maybe one of the moons of Mars, Phobos, or Deimos, you know. I can picture that. But, the closest thing you're going to have is for a gas station will be for SpaceX. He plans on putting a refueling vehicle in Earth orbit. This way, when he launches the Starship that he plans on sending to the moon, he'll be able to refuel them in Earth orbit, and then that vehicle will be able to, you know, pick up speed. It's going 17,500 miles an hour as it's going around the Earth. And it'll be able to get up to that 25,000 miles an hour, like I was saying before, and off it will go to the moon. But, you know, Elon Musk needs these, you got a good word for a gas station and fueling stations in Earth orbit. So that'll be the first one that they have. They've never been able to refuel another vehicle in space. NASA has tried it on the space station experimentally. They have these connections and valves on the outside of the space station, and they've actually, you know, done that just to see if you can refuel something. So they went from one area to another area just to see how the connections would work and all. But can you imagine this being done with these massive vehicles? You know, Starship stands, what, 220 feet high? I think, let's see, the booster is 220 feet, and I think Starship is 160 feet tall. You know, this massive 24-foot diameter tank. You know, you got to fill these things up. One's oxygen, one's liquid methane. You know, multiple flights just to fill up the service tank. And then, you know, after that, you're going to send another vehicle to dock with it, to refuel, to launch to the moon. You know? we'll see. We'll see what happens. They have plans. You know, I have plans too, but I don't think I'm going to make my plan. I don't think they're going to make their plan either anytime soon. Maybe someday, you know. I'm looking at, they said 2028. I hope they can do that. Get everything done by 2028. I think they're counting their chickens before they hatch. Any comments?
No comment, Paul. No comment.
Echo a chance to see if they could get in. I don't hear anybody from Echo. Unless Frank is listening, doesn't have anything to say, that could be. I'll stand by one more time. Anybody for Echo Link?
am here, WB2BXO, but didn't really have anything to add. Thanks very much for letting me through, though.
Oh, okay. It's good that you were there. Very good, Frank. And yeah, we really have to pause here to make sure that works. And it does work. Let's see. Voyage 1 is back online. By the way, Roy had that story on his site tonight about Voyage 1. Now, back on X-Band, a couple of months ago, they noticed they had problems, they've lost any kind of science capability, anything from Voyager 1. But, you know, they transmit back on X-Band. And what happened was they had set the signal for Voyager to shut a heater down, and they believe what happened was it tried to do that, and something went awry on the spacecraft, and when that happens, the spacecraft is programmed to do certain things, and in this case, whatever the problem it saw, it said, okay, I have to shut down X-band, I have to save energy. And I'm just going to switch over to S-band, which is a lot, a lot less wattage. And it did that. Unfortunately, S-band was not heard from this vehicle since the 1980s. You know, that's really meant to be used when, you know, you're relatively close to Earth. And, you know, it gives you a good idea of all, you know, the Voyager 1 equipment, make sure everything's okay. S-band, close by Earth, no problem. You get far away, and then you need more power. And they use the X-band. So since it switched over to S-band, and they knew that that's probably what happened. They started listening to S-band on this deep space network, thinking, well, maybe we can hear it. Sure enough, they heard it. They heard the signal from Voyager 1. So that didn't tell them much, but it told them that, you know, some of the equipment that the health of the vehicle, but not enough to bring back science. They really needed to go back to the X-band. So the Voyager team transmitted information back to Voyager 1 to see if it would do that, and sure enough it did, and now they're back on X-band, and now they're receiving science data again, which is amazing. This thing was launched, what, 1977? And Voyager 2, they were launched, I think, within 2 weeks apart. And they're both still functioning, which is amazing. Just to receive a signal from Voyager when it transmits takes almost 24 hours. Another 24 hours to transmit something back. So, you know, you send the message up, you got to wait for almost 2 days before you find out if the message was received and any information that Voyager is trying to send back to Earth. Any comments?
WB2BXO with a comment.
Sure, go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I was wondering if the issue with the S-band transponder, or transmitter, I guess, probably is actually a transponder because of the way they deal with the commands. But I would think the issue is that the S-band antenna, because it's a lower frequency, around 2.4 gigs, what we use for today for our Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, is probably quite a bit less gain than the X-band antenna, which is much narrower bandwidth, and probably more gain. So I don't know if the issue is so much the power level, but the gain of the antenna. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought it was both, you know. I mean, the article did say that X-band uses more power to transmit. So they have that traveling wave tube and all. S-band, I thought, had an Omni antenna. So, you know, that's usually the way they do it. Or sometimes they have three Omni antennas, you know, different locations this way, no matter where the spacecraft is facing. You know, they can still get a signal back. So I still haven't figured that out yet, Frank. So I'm looking for information on the S-band.
Yeah, if it's an Omni antenna, it would have, in all likelihood, a lot less gain than the X-band antenna, which my guess is the X-band antenna is a very focused, narrow beam. Obviously not as narrow as a laser, but at 10 gigahertz, you can do a narrower beam and more gain than you can do at S-band. And the ERP would be much lower if you use an Omni antenna. I doubt very much it's a collinear gain, collinear array with gain at the horizon, because that just wouldn't be meaningful for a space probe, though I don't really know enough about this stuff. But go ahead.
Yeah, the X-band is being transmitted through that 12-foot dish. And yeah, and then the frequency is, I believe it's 8.47 gigahertz. And you're right about the S-band. I think it's between 2 and 4. Yeah, I think it's a little above the microwave frequency, microwave oven frequency. So, you know, the only reason that they were able to receive it is over the decades, they've upgraded the deep space network. You know, in some cases the antennas are bigger, in most cases the detectors, the low noise detectors that they have are just, you know, world apart from when they were first designed. So they're able to pick up signals that they would have never been able to do back in the 1970s. So, you know, that's part of it too. Transmitting, no problem. They transmit it back. And there's plenty of power, you know, out of the dish down. And by the way, they have to use the dish down in Australia. Australia is south of the equator, and that vehicle is, you know, anytime they contact Voyager, they're always using that one. I bring it up on a deep space network now and then, and it's always coming out of the out of Australia anytime they're contacting Voyager 1. But Voyager 2, they, you know, they could use the other ones, Goldstein and Madrid, Spain. Goldstein and Madrid work fine, but not Voyager 1. You know, they're both going different directions off the ecliptic plane. And one's going kind of like 30 degrees south, you know, and the other one's more or less, the other one's closer to being on the ecliptic plane. Well, we'll see. I hope they make it to 50 years, you know. They need, what, another 3 years or so to keep working, and they can make it to 50 years, both of them. Back to you, friend.
Yeah, now, I'm not sure if you noticed. If I remember correctly, I think a buddy of mine explained to me the way this works is on the big dishes, they have the ability to narrow their filter to like 1 hertz. I think the narrowest most of our ham radio filters can go, I think the Flex radio can go down to 100 hertz. But my understanding is that 1 or 2 hertz bandwidth, which they need for these extremely weak signals, you can't take data at that rate, because as soon as you start taking data, you're going to pop out of the passband. A CW signal, for example, at 20 words a minute, I think is 20 hertz is wide. That was probably just very confusing, but that's my understanding of why they probably couldn't take data at S-band, because they were receiving like the 1 hertz filter. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. Well, you're probably right. They did say that they were able to get information, you know, about the health of the spacecraft. Some of it, anyway. Some data, but maybe that's minimal. Maybe they could get that if they try to get the data from a plasma experiment on board. That's probably quite a bit of data to send down. You know, it would take a month of Sundays maybe to do it. Maybe they could do it, but it would just take forever. But I don't know that you know. If they didn't get X-band working, this thing would have been toast. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I hit the wrong button on the phone. It sounds that way, so they may have been able to fiddle around with it and eke out just enough bandwidth to take data very slowly at S-band. It sounds like it sounds like even though they might have been able to track it, they might not have been able to get science data anymore. Anyway, fortunately, it sounds like they're going to get the TPX band radio working for a while longer. With a 12-foot dish, I guess the statistics are somewhere, but that has an incredibly narrow bandwidth and a lot of forward gain. Probably well beyond what we're capable of in the ham community. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. And both these vehicles have those traveling wave tubes, and they're still working. And I remember a couple of years ago, I found an article that said that they have two, each one has two traveling wave tubes, and each one is supposed to still be working. Well, we'll see. I have to research that as well. Anyway, they still work. And I think they're down to less than 20 watts. The number keeps going down year after year. We'll see. Here's an article I came across recently. It had to do with astronaut Owen Garriott. It's qualifying W5LFL. And they're coming up to, it's actually already been 40 years since he made his first transmission, ham transmission, on board the space shuttle. And, you know, it's before they had Ares, amateur radio on the International Space Station. They had Sarex. He started Sarex, which is a shuttle amateur radio experiment. And they used to do that every now and then. And I remember Dick talking about it. He made contact with one of the people that was able to hear them, and he tried transmitting up. And he said at one point, he says he thinks he got his signal through. So it's been a long time. Just want to bring that up before I close. Owen Garriott, W5LFL. You know, he's already passed on, but he had a son, and his son eventually became an astronaut. His son became wealthy. He got involved with investing in these some game, electronic game company. I forget which one it was. They got really rich, and he was able to eventually pay. At the time, it was around $20 million. Now it's, I think, $50 or $80 million to have a seat on a Progress vehicle, a Russian vehicle, up to the International Space Station for a week to 10 days. That's what his son did. Anyway, it was the first time that you had a father and then a son, wound up being astronauts.
That time complete.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. Gary was an interesting guy. He spent time on Skylab as well before the shuttle program. And he didn't have a ham lab. No Radio Shack on Skylab. That would have been great. You know, he had three different crews visit that Skylab over the years. You know, first one they stayed about, first three people some odd days, and then 40 some odd days. The last one was about 85 days or something on board there, Skylab. Too bad they didn't have a 2-meter radio back then. Anyway, looks like the time coming to a grinding halt here. We'll turn it back over to Roy in a second. Thank everybody that participated, everybody that listened. We'll be back next week. And for now, we'll be back on tomorrow night for the ClubNet on this frequency as well, and find out what's new. Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, here I am, AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who helpfully participated tonight. There was one who didn't really helpfully participate, but hopefully, he'll get cirrhosis. Who knows? I just want to mention the Flex Radio was, Frank mentioned it. I believe it is narrowest bandwidth filter can go as far down as 50 hertz. Can't do one, but it can do 50 hertz. Anyway, our rebels now are done, gentlemen, as Dick always used to end these technical nets.